Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the fire. I'm Kylie Payne. Alright, so I'm really excited about today's episode because I'm talking to a friend from Montevallo. She graduated a couple years ago and has been, pursuing what she learned in school and is, making a living and is making that the focus of her work. And I've been, pretty interested in what she's been doing, but just haven't been able to, make it out to some of the events that she's been putting on. So she was, kind enough to join me and come on the podcast and talk to me and let you all know what she's up to and why it's important. These episodes sort of are a little polarizing, I guess. Some of them will be very cyberpunk-esque and the coming singularity. And then there's other episodes where it's just, very much looking at the flip side and just technology and its hold on us and how it's separating us and doing things that we are not immediately aware of through its application. Perhaps there are unintended side effects. Regardless, there are things that we need to examine and be aware of. I touch on this a little bit through our conversation later on, but for me, it's like I grew up, I knew the original 150 Pokemon. I could guess what they were from their silhouettes. But I couldn't tell you one tree from another or one bird from another, and that's something that I feel like has really been lost on my generation, or at least people within my generation with a similar upbringing as me, having this sort of strong connection with a manufactured reality, because when you surround yourself with screens all the time, like that's a manufactured reality. That's like everything is calculated and created with a purpose and an intent. And being in a capitalist society, more often than not, that intent is to create a profit. And so, that's just a little unnerving to me. And that's why I feel like, if we're going to have technology, this intimate relationship with technology, then it needs to be on our terms, and it needs to be something that, we are consciously aware of, no different from how we should be consciously aware of food that we're putting in our bodies and the air that we're breathing and all of that. I'd made a little Facebook status a while back, and that's another thing. Like, I feel like, if social media wasn't around, maybe I'd be keeping a journal, but I just turn to this website and jot down my ideas and what's on my mind, and it's a collective, it's a shared journal, but it's a bit more, well, on some levels impermanent, and on other levels entirely permanent, because it, the feed sort of selects what you see, and so sometimes, it's like you don't get an accurate representation of what's being put out, but it's all being kept there, logged forever, somewhere on some hard drive. So maybe we'll get that information back to us at some point. Like, maybe someday there'll be like a physical Facebook that, it's just a compiled list of all your statuses and conversations and pictures and all neatly, cataloged and arranged chronologically, they'll sell that back to us. If you haven't noticed, I'm ranting a little bit, but I'm going to allow it on this occasion. All right, here it goes. Meme check. When's the last time somebody told you lost the game? It's been a while for me, but I had a realization some time ago. Whoever started that meme had the wrong idea because you should be aware of your own breathing. Find comfort in it. Notice the space between your breaths. That's you, right there, in between the ins and the outs, on every crest and trough. How could you have lost the game? Unless the game was to remain unaware of what you are, a living, breathing being. Remain unaware of this ever-changing experience and instead play a game of masks and titles and fake paper money. If there is an Illuminati, they created this meme. And they placed it in our heads when our minds were still forming to keep the generation raised on the internet from looking in the right direction. So, guess what? You won the game. Now, stop playing and start being. All right, so there's my rant. Hope you enjoyed it. Getting back on topic. So, yeah, I'm talking to Cameron Strauss, who is the creator of Deep Roots Apothec and Clinic. And you can find her on Facebook or just on the internet in general. I will have links to her stuff in the show notes. She practices herbalism and comes from like a background in ecology. I don't think that's like the actual name of the degree, but that is the philosophy that is being touted. And it is in my opinion, a very worthwhile one that I hope at the end of this conversation you will consider going on your own and trying to learn a little bit more about it. Because the ideas that it puts forward are very profound and potentially life-changing. So, with that, I'm going to segue into the episode. Hope you enjoy it, and I will see you on the other side.
Yeah. It was warmer in the sun. Oh.
All right, and we're recording now, looks like it.
Hi.
Cool. Levels look good. All right, so here at Eclipse, January afternoon, fairly chilly now. Sitting here with Cameron Strauss.
Hi.
And so yeah, it's like the first day of the semester. And I know I've got a class later on today, and so yeah, like glad we were able to meet up and get to sit down and do this.
Yeah.
I've been talking about it for a little while, and yeah, so we met through like Environmental Club a couple years back, and
There you are.
All right, that's fine. All right. So yeah, I met an environmental club a couple years back, and it's like I remember, I guess there's like a lot of stuff from being with that club and some of the stuff that we were doing, and then you've gone on to do some other interesting things since then. So
Yeah.
I wanted that to sort of be the some of the points we touched on in the conversation today.
Awesome.
So I guess like one of the topics I wanted to talk about was like ecology.
Yeah.
What Like, when I say that word, what does that bring to mind for you?
So in my mind, ecology, I think we have a tendency to kind of shrink it down to less than what it is, and we have a tendency to think that it's just maybe plants and animals and their connections and how they interact with each other. And I think that we oftentimes have this separatist attitude of kind of disconnecting ourselves from that. And so it is the scientific analysis and the study of interactions between organisms and their environment, and that includes us. So for me, ecology has kind of broadened itself as I've gotten older and as I've become more connected with plants and my natural environment. It's become my interactions with animals and plants and people and how in a healthy cycle we're supposed to interact, and how we impact our how we impact our environment and the role we play in that, either healthfully or not. So, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty encompassing definition. Like, you know, if you just do like a quick, I guess, like a Google search and pull it up on Wikipedia, it's sort of like, you know, pretty quickly divides it into, yeah, like the academic side, and then it refers to, like, I guess, like political ecology and people, yeah. You know, like that with the activist sort of leanings.
Yeah.
And I can see how it's, you know, more, I guess, you know, of like a spectrum, like somebody could start out, you know, in one camp, and then, like, as they begin to study this and really come to understand it, begin to see that connection that they share.
Yeah.
With all of it, and then become passionate about wanting to see these systems remain intact.
Yeah, I think that the thing that the integral piece of the puzzle that begins to come through for people as they study more and more is the sense of awe. And if you don't respect something and if you don't love it and you're not in awe of it, then you won't preserve it. And I think that that's a super big piece of the puzzle. Also, and you know, it's innate in our hardwiring. We're supposed to be really connected with nature. And
right.
I think that disconnection I see in my clinic a lot. People are really unhappy and disconnected in their lives, and it's because they lack a connection with nature. And, you know, it's almost ergonomic.
Mm.
Our evolution and connection with the environment is almost an ergonomic thing. You know, mm. Our hands were made for cutting down trees and stripping the bark off and making baskets with that, and
mm-hmm.
You know, we're literally designed for living outside and being in that environment. So,
and like, you know, sort of echoing off that, like, you know, it's been sort of chilly lately, and I've got, you know, space now where I'm living to, you know, have a fire every now and then. So, like, you know, a couple nights recently we've had some fires.
Awesome.
And like that, it just, you know, it's so easy and so, I don't know, it just feels natural. It feels like this is, you know, like this is something that we have been doing for
yeah.
the longest time, and so
it's
like
super, it feels natural.
Yeah.
Which is the funny, you know, we say like, oh, they're so natural at something,
mm.
or, you know, it feels natural, but, and we use that word, and, you know, why do we use that word?
Right.
What does that really mean?
Uh-huh.
What are we really saying?
Where is that sense coming from?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's like, you know, it could just easily, like, you know, step inside and you know, turn the TV on and get that artificial glow,
yeah.
but then, like,
but it feels
go,
cheap.
Yeah.
There's nothing, deeply satisfying about sitting down and watching a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
It it's deeply satisfying in this very, like, bad for you way. Do you know not? You
yeah.
know the difference
it's
in
like,
that feeling?
It's fleeting. Like, it's
yeah.
there when you're watching it, and then, like, as soon as the show's over, it's like, okay, well, that show's over. Where's the next one? Oh, that's the end of the series. Gotta find something else to watch now, and then you're
yeah.
just back. It's
yeah.
this cycle.
Yeah, instead of this being, like, you built a fire and you feel this deep commitment as it slowly burns away.
Right.
And then it's bedtime and you lay down with the smell of smoke in your hair. Yeah, there's nothing. There's a huge difference between that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then yeah, it's like, I guess, you know, it's like more participatory. It's like something that, yeah, you're
creating,
you're maintaining, and seeing it to its end.
The birth and death of fire.
Yeah.
Very primal.
Yes, like, you have, like, sort of like a brief history of the word, like, ecology, like how that, like, sort of entered our vocabulary.
Oh, Lord. You know, I really don't know. I really don't. Sorry.
Oh, that's cool. All right, so, I guess, like, how did you start coming to, like, that, like, ecology and, like, what was your first experience with, finding that relationship?
I think it grew. I think at first it was kind of this, like, odd curiosity, and... You know, my dad's a forester, my mom's a florist, and my grandfather used to grow plants for Sears Roebuck. And so I think that, and, you know, I come from a lineage of human beings. And we so I think, it is innate in us, I think, but it was like a seed that got planted, you know, when I was young playing around outside in the woods. And just over time, as I've gotten older, the connection has deepened because I've allowed it. A lot of times we're like, oh, we have other things to do, we have to play on the computer or do work or go to school or whatnot. And when you really make time for being outside and allow your childish your childlike curiosity to take over, it's incredibly therapeutic to be able to follow the tracks of a deer or to wonder what this plant does and to follow that to its logical conclusion. What does it taste like? What does it make you, how does it make you feel in your body? All of these questions that we just don't make the time for. And so if you can go spend a lot of time outside, like I was saying before, you just begin to have this sense of awe. And it feels natural.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it just grows, and if you allow it to grow, it's gonna turn into a hardwood. You know, it's no longer a seedling for me.
Something that's like, I guess, so, like, you know, interesting to me is like there's people that I'll meet like out in Birmingham or whatever, and like having just like, you know, various conversations, and it's like I find that people with like, you know, like generations that came before me, like, seem to a closer connection to a lot of that. Like, I mean, I remember being outside as a child and, you know, my dad taking me out into the woods and that sort of stuff. But, I guess I remember him telling me things, but like, I wasn't exposed enough for it to really like stick and like to really like, you know, get its roots in. So like, you know, when somebody's talking about like all the different various like, you know, species of fish that are in the water or different like trees, and it's like that's like something that like I look at it and I was like, oh, those are trees, but I can't discern it. And so for someone to be able to like look at that and be able to say, well, this is all the different, like, that's something that escapes me, and I recognize that's like something that's, you know, like absent in me, and I feel like I should have a stronger connection to that.
I think one of the things, you know, we beat ourselves up about things like that, but it just takes time. You know, it's just like you meet a person and you don't know their name, but you've met them once, right? And you see them again, and then you see them again, and then you see them again. And then third time, you're like, maybe I should remember their name. What's your name again? It's just like that with remembering trees or plants or birds or whatever. Is the more that you, if you put an intention towards starting to recognize trees, at first you're super overwhelmed and you're just like, I don't even know any of these. This is so frustrating. But if you can overcome your own frustration, and just continue to be like, all right, let me remind myself what that tree's name is again, because I keep seeing it. And if you keep seeing it over and over again and you're cognizant about trying to learn how to recognize it, you're going to remember it eventually, just like you would that person's name. Because if you make it a point to make that tree important, then it's going to become important.
Right. That makes sense. And like, last year, you know, like, I guess, you know, tried to, like, garden a little bit, and, you know, like, I was over at my mom's, and I guess, like, there's, like, just really good soil, like, when we were, like, digging into the ground, like, you know, got, like, you know, about a foot deep, and we were finding, like, bits of, like, coal.
Yeah.
And, so, yeah, like, we, you know, grew, and I guess, you know, just, like, some various flowers, and, was, like, did some, giant sunflowers that just were, like, massive.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, fun. I enjoyed being able to do that. And again, yeah. like see, like, you know, start it, maintain it, and then see it to its end.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm going to try that again this year. Like, yeah. We got some raised beds that we're starting to build in our backyard. Yeah. So going to try to do some stuff there.
So is your mom an avid gardener?
No, like when I was growing up, she had a little flower bed, yeah. in the backyard, and then, I guess, you know, grew older, and then, you know, she, you know, didn't have as much time for it, and so it just sort of, you know, grew over, but, yeah. And then, like, you know, where she's at now, like, you know, we just noticed that the ground seemed to be pretty good, and, you know, I thought we'd, you know, help her, you know, make the place look a little bit nicer, so we just, you know, put some yeah. flowers for her, and, you know, awesome. That was a reason to come by and help, like, you know, do stuff and be over there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I was just, like, you know, trying to, little by little, trying to get closer and more connected.
Yeah.
And so, I guess from there, like, Environmental Club, again, like, that was, like, I learned a lot from being involved in that. And so I guess, yeah, could you share with us some, like, your experiences of being with the club and some of the things that you were able to accomplish?
So I think with Environmental Club, it was an amazing group. We had a really good group while I was in school here. And we had a lot of projects that we really worked hard on. And I think we were really successful while we were here because we were working on projects that maybe had been in the gestation phase during right. you know, years prior.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the community garden officially, and yeah. We actually started it once, and then had to break that down because of horrible flooding. And so we had to kind of regroup and reassess and make it more accessible. And we ended up moving from this field to a field space that was kind of hard to get to the old archery range. And so we ended up building that up and raising the funds for a solar powered water pump, and got a shed donated and moved, and got some tools donated, and it was just a really fantastic group of people that really banded together to create this wonderful space. And I worked a lot on the institutional side to try and make sure that it was inserted into curriculum and into the culture, so that when I left, that it wasn't just there.
Right.
And nobody was using it. And so, you know, to bring that full circle, I think a lot of the lessons that I learned was that no one is an island. And we have a tendency to believe that that we can do things alone, and that we can do things by ourselves. And that's a very American model,
right.
you know, that we learned this of our own accord, or we did this. But if you look at Native cultures, they don't ever, that's almost a silly idea. You
yeah.
know, you teach, you are taught by someone. You learn things because of other people instructing you, because knowledge is inherently passed down from one mind to another. So, you know, it was a really important lesson for me working here and working towards, you know, environmental causes, is that the more connected you are, the stronger that the bonds are, and the more integral your projects become to the culture of where you're working. And so that's super duper important in creating a system that actually works for people, is asking lots of questions, getting information from people, finding out why people are not going there, or what would work for them, or what their schedules are, or what they want from a garden, or whether they even have time for one, or you know, these are super, or do they have the information that they need? Are they flying blind and trying to grow vegetables? They know nothing, you know. These are super important questions to ask, and if we don't pull back and get out of this one, you know, one man show lone wolf mentality, then we don't get very far. And so, you know, I think working with the Environmental Club here in Montevallo, the community is really a tight-knit community, really interested in progressing and creating really cool, awesome new things. So we have a bike share program that was started after I graduated.
Yeah.
And we started the Green Fund during when Kylie and I were in Environmental Club together. So those systems and projects are continuing on, and they've, you know, I graduated in 2011 and the projects are still up and running today because I think we really had that in mind.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that that's awesome that, you know, it's like it was able to do something that you know, has sort of, you know, become self-sustaining, or, you know, it's like has become sufficient enough to where it is able to continue. As yeah, like I still, you know, will drive by the garden, and every now and then I like, you know, try to collect some you know, like food scraps or whatever to put into the, you know, the compost,
yeah.
And you know, still just like doing, you know, something. And
that's great.
Yeah, and it's like with some of the stuff that I guess, like, you know, Colin Williams has done with the like his like environmental arts class,
mm-hmm.
like, and there's like just big murals across the town that are sort of, you know, showing the yeah, like that the ecosystem, that interconnectedness.
Yeah.
It's like there's like another project he did that was like sort of related to Buckminster Fuller, which is like a person who I guess like just sort of recently started looking into, and I like a lot, some of the ideas and terms that like he came up with. Like one of them is like synergy, which is like totally been taken from like what it, you know, he meant it to be, and it's like used, I guess, like I see it like this sort of like, you know, nonsense corporate word that gets thrown around.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I guess, like a couple of his ideas were like sort of like taken and really like misconstrued.
Yeah.
But,
what was his definition of synergy?
It's like it was really lengthy and wordy, which is probably why so much of it got lost. But just showing that like that everything is sort of like interlinked systems, and that you know, they all like function from one another.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I guess like encouraging just like a healthy attitude towards helping one another.
Yeah.
And you know, helping each other thrive and flourish. He also like coined the term spaceship Earth.
Yeah.
So it's like that idea that, you know, we're this closed system, and that you know, we're flying through space.
Yeah.
So yeah, just like a lot of like really like, you know, fun ideas that I think sort of like tie into this notion of, you know, ecology and yeah, like being tied and being one with nature, like that we
yeah.
are nature.
Yeah.
I
think my favorite, when I was looking up Buckminster Fuller, he had this epiphany one day, and he was surrounded in a white bubble of energy, and this voice came to him, and it said to him, "From now on, you need never await temporal attestation to your thought. You need the truth. You think the truth. You do not have the right to eliminate yourself. You do not belong to you. You belong to the universe. Your significance will remain forever obscure to you, but you may assume that you're fulfilling your role if you apply yourself to converting your experiences to the highest advantage of others." Isn't that just the most
yeah.
rock star moment? And, you know, in reality, you can apply that to every single human being's
yeah.
life. You know, that's part of the joy of looking at our connection with nature and synergy and this idea, you know, in Native cultures, every single person was incredibly valuable, and every single person had a genius that was waiting to be unlocked by their family and in support, right? In this web of support.
Yeah.
Everyone was responsible in the community for building each other up to their highest potential, because then everyone benefited.
Right.
And I think we forget that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that quote is just like a big kick to the fanny, right?
Oh, yeah.
You do not belong to you. You belong to the universe. And if you, you know, you need to apply yourself to convert your experience to the highest advantage of others, because you in turn benefit. And, you know, that's what our connections are all about.
Yeah. And it's truly not it's so epic. Misuse of the word epiphany.
I know. Right?
All right. So I guess from there, so what are you doing to help people with, like, you've got a Deep Roots Apothec and Clinic that you're using herbalism to do what?
So most of my work is centered around helping people to feel better. So, and that's super simplified, but basically I'm using herbs, supplements, and lifestyle changes and diet, huge part is diet, to help people be their highest self, be their best, because if people don't feel well, they can't achieve what they want to be achieving. Yeah. And so, you know, it's funny, when I first started, I thought it was just the plants were going to fix everything, but, you know, the old adage is let thy food be thy medicine, right? Mm. So if we don't utilize plants and good healthy food in our
right.
daily life, then we can't expect an herb to just miraculously cure people.
I think that's like the culture that we're coming from is like that's what it encourages, like here's the
pill
miracle.
The magical miracle drug. And it's amazing how often people really seriously neglect their nutrition and think that their brain and body will be able to function properly.
Yeah.
And so a lot of what I do is educate people on that baseline information that, you know, they'll come in and say, oh, I'm depressed. I need to be on, you know, I'm on this antidepressant. Well, you know, my question to them is, why are you depressed? You know, or did you lose your mother? Are you grieving? Did you make time to grieve? Are you eating well? Are you nutrient deficient? Because if you are, then are you spending enough time outside? If you're nutrient deficient and you're not spending enough time outside and your stress level is high, and then your body is saying there's something wrong, and it's sending you a signal that says things are out of balance here. What do we need to do to fix them? And we ignore that and think, oh, we get really sciencey about it. And we say, okay, well, I must have a chemical imbalance. Well, you got a chemical imbalance because things are not functioning properly because you're not nourishing your cells. You're not creating an environment for your body in which it can thrive. And so, you know, people have all sorts of issues like infertility, and no one ever speaks to them about, okay, well, in order to build a baby, you have to have enough stuff in your body for yourself and a little extra
right.
to build a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just, there's kind of this baseline information that people don't really internalize. And so once I can educate to them to a point where they accept this information as something that's really applicable to their health and furtherment, then we start really making progress. And that is where I really try hard to start there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's really insane to have to convince people that their stress level and their diet is integral to their health. But people we just don't think like that.
Yeah.
And you know, I went through my own phase of not believing that. And I had, the reason I'm even an herbalist in the first place is because I had arthritis for years, paired with lots of other health problems that I won't get into. But the main thing that I was really struggling with was this arthritis.
Hmm.
And I was super creaky from the time I was 16 until I was about 23, when I found out that I'm super allergic to dairy, and I'm really allergic to gluten. And dairy and gluten make me have arthritis. And so it took me 2 years of trying dairy on and off and gluten on and off to really internalize the idea that I'm allergic to it and that it's bad for me, and that that's why I have arthritis. So it's this, you know, it's this process. We want to eat dairy, we want to eat bread, we want to eat the soda, we want to have ice cream, And it takes a long time to internalize that that stuff is really not good for the system. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's fine if you do it occasionally. It's fine if you have some ice cream once a month. But if that doesn't agree with your body, then it's not going to help you. It's right. not going to further your health. And, you know, it's completely nutritionally shallow. I mean,
right.
comparatively to, you know, fresh vegetables grown from your garden or wild foods.
Mm.
I mean, why would you pay for vegetables at the grocery store when you can harvest them yourself? You know, these are just questions that I try to pose to people. And a lot sure. of it is just trying to educate people further and reconnect them
mm-hmm.
to their body and reconnect them to these ideas of kind of baseline health, and then helping them to create a map to get there over the course of time, and being patient with them and utilizing the things, the stepping stones that they need to get there. And that's my job, is to find those stepping stones to help people get there, whether it be an idea or a supplement or an herb. However I can create health for them, and however I can help them feel better, and however I can, you know, help people get to that space of health in their mind first, so that they can fully delve into their health and really take it to the next step.
And, like, one of the things I like about that is, I guess, like, you know, or I always like anything that has, like, a DIY ethic to it.
Oh, yeah.
And because, like, that requires, like, somebody to apply themselves, like, take their mind and try to, like, understand something.
Yeah,
and,
which is hugely important.
Yeah. It was, like, you know, we're in this, like, you know, culture, you know, it's very, like, consumers-driven and very much, like you're... It, you know, we're taught that we are not an authority on anything except for that one thing that you went to school for. And so it's like, you know, don't work on your car, get, you know, take it to the mechanic, you know, it's like,
why waste your time with that?
Yeah. And then, like, and I feel like, you know, yeah, with the body, like, you may feel off, but, like, over time, like, you know, you get used to that feeling of being off, and you, like, you adjust, like, well, this is, I guess, the new normal, and, you know, I'm this way now. And then, like, trying to make the comparison to, like, you know, like, on a car, like, you have a light that comes out on the dash, like the check engine light, and people don't have that, or you know, they're not aware of that. Like, you know, there are signs that you can become aware of, but it's not as easy as just, like, the light flicking on. But even that, like, you know, it's like, I know people who have the check engine light on in their car, and they never check, and I was like, well, it drives fine, I'll just keep driving until it isn't driving
until it
anymore.
Collapses,
yeah,
which is what people do to their body.
Uh-huh.
Because we don't pay attention to the inherent check engine lights that are going off,
right?
You know, and sometimes we don't even know that they're going off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I knew that I shouldn't have arthritis at 17, but everybody just kept telling me I was complaining, or that I was
right,
I was fine. I would go to the doctor and they would say I was fine, my labs came back normal, I was fine. I'm like, you know, that voice inside of me was telling me that I was not fine.
Yeah.
And if I had accepted that as truth, then I would have... I would probably be dead at 45. You know?
Right.
I'd be dead.
Yeah.
Because I would have been poisoning myself every day with things I'm allergic to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would have ended up with these chronic, horrible health conditions, which is what happens all the time with people.
Right.
And that's why they're in my office.
And, yeah, like... That's why I think it's, like, you know, so important for, I guess, you know, people to, you know, try to be aware of these things and, you know, be aware of their connection. It's, like, why, I guess, I feel like, you know, ideas of, like, you know, that we learn in ecology, like, why that's important and why that needs to be, you know, applied and, you know, a subject worth talking about.
Yeah. Totally.
So let's see. I don't know. Yeah, like... a couple years ago, I went to this, like, a little, like, convention, and it had, like, a bunch of different workshops on things, and I was just, like, one of the things that, like, I committed to memory from that is, like, I don't remember anything else about the class except for, like, that they said that, like, Queen Anne's lace is, like, you know, grows on, like, roadsides everywhere, and that it has, like, medicinal properties to it, and... But I forget what those properties were. Are you familiar with what Queen Anne's lace does?
It's a diuretic, and I don't use it a lot. I don't teach it a lot either, because people will ID it improperly and think that it's they'll end up poisoning themselves.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. So that why did that stick with you? Why did that particular plant stick with you?
I guess because it's something that, like, you know, maybe I'm misiding it, but it's something that I have seen enough to be like, oh well, that matches the shape in my mind. I can stick a name to that.
Yeah, and people remember things they've seen over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like what I was talking about earlier, that if you've seen it a bunch, then as soon as you hear the name, you'll remember it.
Yeah.
Because you've always, your mind has wanted to know the name for that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even the use.
Do I know?
And maybe even the use.
Oh, yeah. So, I guess, is there anything else you want to, like, bring up? Like, do you have any classes or events coming up that people should know about?
So, we're doing a volunteer training, and the volunteer training is going to be February 20th. And so I bring on apprentices every 6 months. And so I kept having lots of people that wanted to help but couldn't devote that much time. And so I'm offering a volunteer training. And so the volunteer training will be all day February 20th. And people can come and get kind of a crash course in herbalism, and then you know, they'll learn throughout their volunteer service. But I'm kind of asking between 35 and 50 hours of volunteer work if they attend the workshop. So that's going to be really fun. We're going to be filming a medicine making course.
Oh.
February 6th, but we'll be kind of promoting that and publicizing that when it's up and running. I haven't quite figured out all the ins and outs of that yet. Okay. So the other thing we're going to be doing soon is a class at the Botanical Garden. It's a class on spring cleaning and spring cleansing. And so people in the South, this is actually pretty common. A lot of people will know about how their ancestors did spring cleanses to kind of clean the blood after a long, boring winter of lots of fats and meat and preserved dried foods. And so the lymphatic system slows down and the blood thickens. And so, we have a little bit of a buildup of toxicity. And so once the spring comes, it's time to do some cleaning. And so a lot of the plants that come out during that first spring push are particularly wonderful for cleansing the liver and the lymphatic system. And so we're going to be talking a lot about native cleansers for the blood and the lymphatic system. And so that's what that class will be about.
Cool.
And, you know, we're always teaching stuff. We're always expanding. So if you have a request for a class or you want to get in touch with us, you can always email us at deeprootsapothecandclinic@gmail.com. So it's APOTHEKE and AND clinic. And you can also sign up for our newsletter on our website, and it's deeprootsapothecandclinic.com. So
cool.
That's all the tidbits.
And I'll have links and all that stuff in the show notes at the bottom of the page, so those will be available. I guess, like, any other closing remarks?
No, this was really fun.
Awesome.
I'm glad to get to nerd out a little bit about ecology and the connectedness of all.
Oh, yeah. It's always fun. Right.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me, Kylie.
Awesome.
All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I know I did. I wish we would have had more time to delve into some of these topics more thoroughly. And but, you know, we're busy people, and we only had about an hour to record. And, you know, a couple episodes back, when I was talking with Andy Harris, I said at the intro, like, oh, hey, you know, try to be places early because you never know what cool things happen when you get somewhere early. Need to listen to my own advice because I actually got to that appointment 30 minutes late. Fortunately, Cameron didn't have anything going on immediately afterwards, so she was able to hang out for an extra 30 minutes so that we could get, you know, an hour-long conversation in. So yeah. Can't always be on time. Sometimes you're late. It's better late than never. So, but if possible, try to be early. Anyways, like I was saying, really wish we could, you know, get into some of these topics, more thoroughly. Like, I went rummaging through my bookshelf and found a book that was given to me by Bob. You know, he was on an episode a little while back, and, you know, he's given me this, you know, collection of books that I have, you know, when something's piqued my interest, I have thumbed through and read a little bit here and there, but I've not taken the time really to sit down and go from cover to cover with one of them. But I recall getting one book that, you know, thought would match today's conversation or would, you know, sit with it quite nicely. So I went and pulled it out. This book is called Ecology as Politics by Andre Gorz. A-N-D-R-E within an apostrophe, then G-O-R-Z. So yeah, like, you know, like I was saying in the conversation, you know, ecology, you know, one could start from a very academic standpoint, very, you know, like, following the scientific method and using this sort of, like, you know, outside observer. But then as you study more and more of these systems, you find that, you know, you're a part of it, and so there's really no way to maintain objectivity. So I'm going to, if you will allow me, read just the introduction of this book. Once again, that is Ecology as Politics by Andre Gorz. Copyright 1998, published by Black Rose Books. I guess it was first published in French and was translated into English. It was translated by Jonathan Cloud and Patsy Vigerman. I'm not so good with some of those names. So yeah, okay, let me read you this introduction. Introduction. Two kinds of ecology. Ecology is like universal suffrage, or the 40-hour work week. At first, the ruling elite and the guardians of social order regard it as subversive, and claim that it will lead to the triumph of anarchy and irrationality. Then, when factual evidence and popular pressure can no longer be denied, the establishment suddenly gives way. What was unthinkable yesterday becomes taken for granted today, and fundamentally, nothing changes. Ecological thinking still has many opponents on the boardrooms, but it already has enough converts in the ruling elite to ensure its eventual acceptance by the major institutions of modern capitalism. It is therefore time to end the pretense that ecology is by itself sufficient. The ecological movement is not an end in itself, but a stage in a larger struggle. It can throw up obstacles to capitalist development and force a number of changes. But when, after exhausting every means of coercion and deceit, capitalism begins to work its way out of the ecological impasse, it will assimilate ecological necessities as technical constraints and adapt the conditions of exploitation to them. That is why we must begin posing the question explicitly. What are we really after? A capitalism adapted to ecological constraints, or a social, economic, and cultural revolution that abolishes the constraints of capitalism, and in doing so, establishes a new relationship between individual and society, and between people and nature? Reform or revolution? It is inadequate to answer that this question is secondary, and that the main thing is not to botch up the planet to the point where it becomes uninhabitable. For survival is not an end itself either. Is it really worth surviving on a world transformed into a planetary hospital, planetary school, planetary prison, where it becomes the principal task of spiritual engineers to fabricate people adapted to these conditions. Parentheses. Illich. I-L-L-I-C-H. To be convinced that this is the world which the technocrats are preparing for us, one has only to consider the new brainwashing techniques developed by the U.S. and Germany researchers attached to the psychiatric clinic of the University of Hamburg following the work of American psychiatrists and psychosurgeons are exploring ways of eliminating aggressiveness, which prevents people from accepting the most total forms of frustration, those of the prison system in particular, but also those of the assembly line, of urban crowding, of schooling, red tape, and military discipline. We should do well, therefore, to define at the onset what we are struggling for as well as against. And we should do well to try to understand how, concretely, capitalism is likely to be affected and changed by ecological constraints, instead of believing that these will, in and of themselves, bring about its disappearance. To do this, we must first grasp what an ecological constraint means in economic terms. Consider the gigantic chemical plants of Rhine Valley, BASF in Ludwigshafen, AKZO in Rotterdam, or Bayer in Leverkusen. Each of these complexes represents a combination of the following factors: natural resources, air, water, minerals, that until now were considered without value and were treated as free goods because they did not need to be reproduced, i.e., replaced. Means of production, machines, buildings, etc., i.e., fixed capital, which eventually becomes obsolete and must consequently be replaced, reproduced, preferably by more efficient, more powerful ones, so as to give the firm advantage over its competitors. Labor power, which must also be reproduced. The workers must be housed, fed, trained, and kept healthy. Under capitalism, these factors are combined so as to yield the greatest possible amount of profit, for which any firm interested in its future means also the maximum control over resources, hence the maximum increase in its investments and presence on the world market. The pursuit of this goal has a profound effect on the way the different factors are combined and the weight given to each. Corporate management is not, for instance, principally concerned with making work more pleasant, harmonizing production with the balance of nature and the lives of people, or ensuring that its products serve only those ends which communities have chosen for themselves. It is principally concerned with producing the maximum exchange value for the least monetary cost. And to do that, it must give greater weight to the smooth running of the machines, which are costly to maintain and replace, that to the physical and psychic health of the workers, who are readily replaceable at low cost. It must give greater weight to lowering the cost of production than to preserving the ecological balances whose destruction will not burden the firm financially. It must produce what can be sold at the highest prices, regardless of whether cheaper things might be more valuable to the community. Everything bears the imprint of these requirements of capitalism. The nature of the products, the production technologies, the working conditions, the size and structure of the plants. But increasingly, most notably in the Rhine Valley, the human crowding and the air and water pollution are reaching the point where industry, in order to grow or even continue operating, is required to filter its fumes and effluents. That is, industry must now reproduce the conditions and resources which were previously considered part of nature and therefore free. This need to reproduce the environment has a chain of economic consequences. It becomes necessary to invest in pollution control equipment, thus increasing the mass of fixed capital. It is then necessary to ensure that mortalization, the reproduction, and the purification, but the products of these installations, mainly the restored property of air and water, cannot themselves be sold for a profit. In short, there is simultaneous increase in capital intensity, in the organic composition of capital, in the cost of reproduction, or in the cost of reproducing this fixed capital, and hence in the cost of production, without any corresponding increase in sales. One of two things must therefore occur. either the rate of profit declines or the price of products increases. The firm will, of course, seek to raise its prices, but it cannot get off so lightly. All of the other polluting firms, cement plants, steelworkers, paper factories, refineries, etc., will also seek to force the final consumer to pay higher prices for their goods. The incorporation of ecological constraints will, in the end, have the following results. Prices will tend to rise faster than real wages. Purchasing power will be reduced, and it will be as if the cost of pollution control has been deducted from the income available to individuals for the purchase of consumer goods. The production of these goods will consequently tend to stagnate or fall off. Tendencies towards recession or depression will be accentuated. And this diminution of growth and of production, which in another system might be considered a positive thing, fewer cars, less noise, more air to breathe, shorter work days, and so on, will instead have entirely negative effects. The polluting goods will become luxury items, accessible to the majority, but still available to the privileged. Inequality will intensify. The poor will become relatively poorer, the rich richer. Incorporating ecological costs, in short, will have the same social and economic consequences as the oil crisis. And capitalism, far from succumbing to this crisis, will respond to it in its usual fashion. Those groups financially advantaged by the crisis will profit from the difficulties of rival groups, will absorb them at a low cost, and will extend their control over the economy. The state will reinforce its power over society. Its technocrats will calculate optimal norms of pollution control and production, issue regulations, and extend the domain of the programmed activity and thus the scope of the representative apparatus. Popular resentment will be diverted with compensatory myths and directed towards readily available scapegoats, racial or ethnic minorities, migrant workers, young people, other countries. The state will base its authority not upon consent, but upon coercion. Bureaucracies, police forces, armies, and private security forces will fill the vacuum left by the distribute of party politics and the fossilization of political parties. Already in France and elsewhere, we see signs of this decay all around us. Doubtless, none of this is inevitable, but it is highly probable. If capitalism is compelled to integrate ecological costs without being challenged at all levels by alternative social practices and an alternate vision of human civilization, the advocates of growth are right on one point. Within the framework of the existing society and consumption patterns based on disparity, privilege, and the quest for profit, zero or negative growth can only mean stagnation, unemployment, and the widening gap between rich and poor. Within the framework of the existing mode of production, it is impossible to limit or suppress growth while simultaneously distributing goods more equitably. Indeed, it is the nature of the goods themselves which most often prevents their equitable distribution. How can one equitably distribute supersonic air travel, Mercedes-Benzes, penthouse apartments, and private swimming pools, or the thousands of new products, scarce by definition, which industry floods the market with each year in order to devalue older models and reproduce inequality and social hierarchy? And how can one distribute equitably university degrees, supervisory jobs, management roles, tenured positions? It is hard to avoid the recognition that the mainspring of growth is this generalized forward flight, simulated by a deliberately sustained system of inequalities, which Ivan Illich calls the modernization of poverty. As soon as a majority can aspire to what until then had been exclusive privilege of the elite, this privilege, such as a high school diploma or an automobile, is thereby devaluated. The poverty line is raised by one notch, and the new privileges are created from which the majority are excluded. Endlessly recreating scarcity in order to recreate inequality and hierarchy, capitalist society gives rise to more unfulfilled needs than it satisfies. The growth rate of frustration largely exceeds that of production. Illich. As long as we remain within the framework of civilization based on inequality, growth will necessarily appear to the mass of people as the promise, albeit entirely illusory, that they will one day cease being underprivileged, and the elimination of growth as the threat of permanent mediocrity. It is not so much growth that must be attacked as the illusions which it sustains. The dynamic of ever-growing and ever-frustrated needs on which it is based, and the competition which it institutionalizes by inciting each individual to seek to rise above all others. The motto of our society could be, that which is good for everyone is without value, but to be respectable, you must have something better than the next person. Now, it is the very opposite which must be affirmed in order to break away from this ideology of growth. The only thing worthy of each are those which are good for all. The only things worthy of being produced are those which neither privilege nor diminish anyone. It is possible to be happier with less affluence, for in a society without privilege, no one will be poor. Imagine a society based on this criteria. The production of practically indestructible materials, of apparel lasting for years, of simple machines which are easy to repair and capable of functioning for a century or more. These are scientifically and technologically accessible to us, along with the vast extension of community services facilities like public transportation, laundromats, and so on, thus eliminating much of the need for fragile, expensive, and energy-wasting private machines. Imagine collective dwellings, not as they are now, blighted by the neglect of public space and the privatization of value, but as they might be if individual energies were to be released for the public good and vice versa. There could be two or three recreation rooms, playrooms for children, fully equipped workshops and libraries, an accessible laundry area, and so on. Would we still really require all of our individual equipment which lies idle much of the time? Would we still be eager to join the traffic jams on the freeways if there were comfortable collective transport to receive transport to recreation areas, bicycles and motorbikes readily available when required, an extensive network of mass transit for urban and suburban areas? Imagine beyond this that the major industries centrally planned produced only that which was required to meet the basic needs of the population. Four or five styles of durable shoes and clothing, three or four models of sturdy adaptable vehicles, plus everything needed to provide the collective services and facilities. Impossible in a market economy? No doubt. Entailing massive unemployment? Not necessarily. We could have a 20-hour work week, providing we change the system. Uniformity, monotony, boredom, on the contrary. For imagine the following. Each neighborhood, each town, would have public workshops equipped with a complete range of tools, machines, and raw materials, where the citizens produce for themselves, outside the market economy, the non-essentials according to their tastes and desires, as they would not work for more than 20 hours a week, and possibly less, to produce the necessities of life. The adults would have time to learn what the children would be learning in primary school, not only reading and writing, but also handicrafts of all kinds, sewing, leatherworking, cabinet making, masonry, metalworking, mechanics, pottery, agriculture, in short, all the skills which we are now commercially torn from and replaced with buying and selling. Are such proposals utopian? Why couldn't they have come before, or why couldn't they become a political program? For such a utopia corresponds to the most advanced, not the most primitive, of our form of socialism. To a society without bureaucracy, where the market withers away, where there is enough for everyone, where people are collectively and individually free to shape their lives, where people produce according to their fantasies, not only according to their needs. In short, a society where the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. Marx, the Communist Manifesto, 1848. This introduction, Two Kinds of Ecology, was written by Le Savage, April 1974. Okay, so that was a little wordy. It took a little bit longer to read than what I thought. But yeah, I think it covers some pretty big ideas. And this idea of, like, you know, economy and ecology are rooted in the same word, but they're so different in their application. And I don't know. I don't want to ramble on too long, so I'm just going to let you chew on that until next time. So, once again, check out all of Cameron's stuff. I'll have her links in the show notes. And until next time, be well.